following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, you know, you're probably planning maybe a football party or two. And if that's the case, then you're going to have some food. That's what it is. I mean, you got the big game that's coming up. We'll call it the Super Bowl, even though the NFL hates when I say Super Bowl. But hey, the Super Bowl is coming. And yes, you're going to want to eat because nothing goes better with the game than a big pile of food. Perhaps maybe some cold beverages that are appropriate for the game, right? Well, you're going to want that taste of Memphis, and you can get it from Central Barbecue. Yeah, buddy, they're a big-time institution. Been here for a long, long time. And consistently named the place to go to for some of that slow-smoked rib goodness, the pulled pork goodness. Oh, it's Memphis style, and it's only here. Or is it? It is available everywhere in the United States. You know how? All you have to do is go to their website. You can find their link on our page at radio-memphis.com. Click on it. It'll take you to their page, to their shop. Order the food. They'll deliver it to you. Anywhere in the United States of America, you can get some fresh pork. Oh, my God. And nobody does barbecue the way it's done in Memphis, and especially over at Central. Go check it out. I highly recommend it. Get some pork for your, for your pigskin game. Huh? Hey, how about that? Something to think about as we get started with the show right now. Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland. We had some fun with that one last week, didn't we, with Jerry the King Lawler. Got another good one here for you this time around, too. This was actually taken from a show that we recorded at Radio Memphis from the Booze and Blues show. We'll get to that here in a minute. I want to tell you that my habits, as difficult as they may be to change, have changed personally. Cut the cord. I've been threatening to do it forever. The wife and I finally had enough of AT&T's U-verse and their nonsense. I wasn't going to go the Xfinity route because, quite frankly, they're just as bad. It's corporate-driven cable television nonsense.
You will watch this, and you will pay us that.
And it's true. You know, you drop $200 or more a month in your television services, and you're watching... You find that when you sit there and go, well, I've got like, 500 channels. And you go through them and you realize that it's 480-something channels you never watch. You know? So we cut it. We had enough. Enough is enough. And so we told them to shove it up their ass. They weren't too happy about it. It's, the whole customer retention thing is the way they go with it. Which is, all well and good. That's what they try and do. Because they don't want to lose that $200 a month. AT&T, especially since they just bought the DirecTV deal, they finally acquired it. They paid some ungodly amount of money for it. And then, it's, I've been threatening to dump out of the whole cable television thing for a while, and I wanted to do it right. And I'd heard a lot about smart TV. It's not really all that smart, really. It's kind of complicated if you really get into it. Or you can, go the simple route, which is what we did. We jumped right on in and got us one of them Roku rigs. And we figured, look, for half of what we pay 1 month, we own the damn thing. We have an internet connection here, so away we go. And I've been still sort of tinkering with it and I'm watching a little bit. It looks great, sounds great to me. There's some things that you don't quite get with it. But I tell you what, man, I'm digging it. The more I think about it, the more I realize. I mean, what I was paying per month, I could pay per year and get fantastic stuff. So, there's probably somebody that's out there sitting there going, well, damn, Rick, you're just, welcome to the 21st century, bro. I finally jumped in. I don't watch as much television as the immigrant does. But she's very particular about some of the things that she watches, as is anybody, I suppose. But she likes to watch the sports. And sports and smart TV, they have them. Boy, howdy. The NFL wants a lot of money for their deal. There's that. But, you're still paying far less for what you would be paying a cable television provider. God damn, I didn't realize just how greedy and corporate these people are. It's brutal, I tell you. It's absolutely brutal. So, I'm done with them. And it's, it's nice being able to stand up and go against the grain, and it doesn't, it's not just cable television. I mean, it's everything, there's just some things I refuse to take part in because of the way, I don't go to Walmart. I don't go to fast food joints. I don't do any of that stuff because it's just I'm sick and tired of our lives being controlled by these massive corporate conglomeration bullshit places where they just they have you by the balls. That's the sad thing, and it's unfortunate, but you know, you can do so much better. It takes a while to get used to it. It's like, you know, I don't go to Kroger either. It's the same reason. I mean, I'm sort of stuck there because there's a prescription that I have there, and I need to move it. But I don't buy anything other side from, and it's just a pharmacy. And their pharmacy services, you know. But I don't want to go. I want to do my grocery shopping there. I really don't. I don't like that it's all this. It just feels so mass produced and plastic because it's probably what it is. You know, I find me a homegrown store that is, you know, owned locally, which is that seems better. I've gotten to know the people that go that use that store. And I don't buy everything there. I go to other markets. You know, I get produce from another place. I get fruits from another place. I get certain stuff from, you know, there's like three or four stores that we go to. So shopping is always an adventure around our house. But you know, I feel better about it because I'm not stick, you know, I'm not having to be, you know, stuck with this whole deal with having to go to, you know, well, you can go to Kroger and you can get everything. No, fuck Kroger. I'm so sick and tired of it. And it's just, no. And Walmart's the same way. No. It actually made me feel pretty good when I heard that Walmart was closing a bunch of stores. I feel sorry for the people that were working there, but it's not like they were making a lot of money out of the deal. Sad nonetheless. So, you know, what are you going to do? All right, kids. We got a great show for you this time out. We've got some music, too, as we do. And it's funny because it's kind of one in the same package. Some time ago, we had the great Willie Two Big Hall in our studios at Radio Memphis, live on the air for an episode of Booze and Blues. Jeff and I had a nice conversation with Willie. We've known Willie for a while. He's been on with us a couple of times. And we talked a lot about the movie The Blues Brothers. And we spent some time talking about one of the guys that he worked with, too, which was Isaac Hayes. Oddly enough, we've got some Isaac Hayes music coming up a little bit later on in the show. So that's pretty cool. So that happened. But yeah, Willie's a great guy. A lot of fun. We were having a big time with him. And as I mentioned, he was in the studio with us and we recorded it and had a fun conversation about his life with the Blues Brothers and working with, you know, the Bar Keys and with Isaac Hayes. And you'll hear more about that, too, when we get to his music coming up a little bit later on. So here's how it all went. Hope you enjoy it. It happened live at radio-memphis.com. It's our conversation with the great Willie Two Big Hall.
You're looking good.
Yeah, thank God, man. Hello, world. Yeah. Hey, Kathy.
Yeah, she's tuned in from Australia.
Yeah, thank God.
You know, the last time, this is actually your third time here. The last time we were here, you got hijacked by Jim Dandy.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry about all that.
No, you know, Jim and I go way back, man, to the early 70s when he was, when that band was called Nobody Else.
Mm-hmm.
I think they changed their name when they joined the Stax label. They were on a subsidiary label of Stax.
Right.
And Jim and I spent a lot of time together late at night. His band would rehearse in the studio, in Studio B, late at night because, you know, everybody was going home. There'd only be the security people there.
Sure.
And at that time, I was experimenting in Studio C, which was a demo studio. They had a 4-track machine and a 2-track machine. And a friend of mine, one of the engineers, he had taught me how to run the machines. And so I'd go in with my guitar and my bass guitar, and I'd put my own tracks down and, you know, write songs. So late at night like that, man.
So they would let you do that? Just, you know, just come on in and now you didn't have to pay for it? Or
No.
Don't make a mess and, you know.
Yeah. There was such freedom and such camaraderie at Stax, man. You wouldn't believe it. But, you know, I was a much different person when I was younger, man. You know, I had a great reputation, and you know, I was trusted. So
I trust you, Willie.
Thank you. So I would come in late at night like that. My wife and kids would be in bed. My wife worked a regular job, and the kids went to school. And Isaac Hayes he kept us up so late at night. Usually Isaac would like to work, unless he was doing a session with like Billy Eckstein or somebody like that who would record in the daytime.
Right.
Isaac would do his recordings late at night. So we would usually start from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m.
Right.
So whenever Isaac would come in the studio and tell us, hey, guys, something's come up, I won't be able to do it. That something come up would usually be a chick. But when he would come in and tell us, hey, guys, something up, we're not going to be doing anything tonight. Oh, man, we would feel so great because we'd get a chance to go home and see our families.
Sure.
So I had adapted that time slot. And so I would come in late at night and do a little writing, and Jim then would be down the hall, man, just blasting.
Right.
So I'd go hang out with them and listen to the band.
That's cool. Yeah, there was a lot of remarkable freedom in all of that, wasn't there?
Yeah, man. As I said, not only for the times, you know, the late 60s,
yeah,
throughout the late 70s, there was such a freedom in the expression of music.
Yeah.
And then there was such a camaraderie between the musicians at that time. I know a friend of mine, two friends of mine, that I must give credit to. They sort of opened the doors and brought me into the realm of rock music. And that was David Cochran and Buddy Davis.
Yeah.
They sort of adopted their little black friend, you know, to play drums, because I've always been like a Beatles fan.
Right.
You know, I grew up in that era, man, and I came from Pensacola, Florida. We only had like two stations, and at night, one of the stations would completely shut down, so we would listen to JR out of Nashville, and most of the stuff that he played would be like Roy Orbison.
Right.
What's my boy out of Vegas, Wayne Newton, and the Beatles.
And yeah.
I was rock pop oriented by the time I got to Memphis. My family moved here in 1965. So Buddy and David, you know, they were into the Led Zeppelin, the Three Dog Night. That thing was happening.
Yeah.
And so sometimes during the daytime, they would say, Willie, you got a minute, man, in between sessions or whatever. I said, sure, man. And we'd run over to David's house, man, and or Buddy's house, and we'd do a doobie, and we'd get loose, man. We would play for hours, man. They good rock music. And so these guys
were y'all just playing covers just to kind of get a feel for what was making that sound? I mean, you know, you mentioned the Beatles, and you and I have talked about this before. Ringo... There was always a running gag about the Beatles. You know, you had, you know, John was the real soul of it, and Paul was the heart of it, and George was the real backbone of it, and Ringo was the drummer. But people have always given Ringo a lot of business for that. But he's actually, you know, you're inspired by him, aren't you?
Of course, man. I mean, even today when I play, I see Ringo had this thing. Where he'd shake his head.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he still does that, too, yeah.
Yeah, I find myself doing the same thing.
Do you really?
Dr. Brown can contest to that, because at his place, he doesn't like for you to call it a club. It's called the Plex.
Yeah. In fact, I drove by it the other night. I had a thing over in West Memphis, and I went, that's where it is. I couldn't stop, and I don't think it was like on a Monday night. I don't think you guys were open.
Because it's set up real nice, and it's got the green screen behind us, and it's set up for video, and he does a lot of that. But we play there together every Friday night, and when I'm playing, I always think about Ringo, and I shake my head like him, man. I mean, I do that, actually. He inspired me a lot, because I was an avid Beatles fan. I mean, I could have cried if I had been a girl. That's how much I love the Beatles, man. And I know you can. I tell you this: you can play any three beats, maybe sometimes even less, of any Beatles song, and I can tell you.
And you know,
tell you what it was.
Man. Is there a favorite generation of the Beatles for you? I mean, because they're only around for like 10
years.
Yeah,
there were a few phases.
There was like eight records, right?
Yeah, they went through the what do you call that, with the Krishna guy with the
The psychedelic stuff,
yeah, right? They went through the psychedelic
Robbie
stuff.
Shankar, yeah,
and the early stuff was like the teenage love stuff, you know, She Loves Me.
Mm-hmm.
Songs like Knowing She Would or Norwegian Wood,
yeah,
you know, I love that stuff there. Ticket to Ride, Penny Lane, all that stuff, man. I love the Beatles.
Was Sergeant Pepper an influential album for you?
Sergeant Pepper Sergeant Pepper was a mystery to me for a long time because there was so much information involved. And you really, one thing I admire about them, they created that mystique. And you had to actually get involved to understand what all the controversy about. Like the thing about crossing Abbey Road when Paul only had on, had his shoes off.
Yeah, he was barefoot, I think. Yeah.
And then the MGs did a replica of that in their Macklemore Avenue album. Mm-hmm. And so the thing about Paul being killed, the actual real Paul being killed in the car accident.
Right.
And all that whole thing. So Sergeant Pepper was like... there was so much going on during that time. I think Motown and the Temps had come out with all the psychedelic stuff from the Temps.
Right.
So there was a lot of information going on right there. And it was really a mystery, you know, that you had to unravel. But Sergeant Pepper, I think, was a good collaboration. But I'm sort of partial to the earlier stuff.
The earlier stuff.
The Beatles.
Rubber Soul and Meet the Beatles,
and,
the first records, yeah.
What was the one? Dun, 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 dun. And I love her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Great song.
So yeah. I like two kinds of music. I like the funk, and then I'm a romantic. You know, I like the sweet stuff, too.
Well, you know, with the funk, you were there from the beginning, though. I mean, you're a very instrumental person from that moment that really became mainstream.
Right.
You know, here you are sitting there with Isaac Hayes and doing all this magical stuff in that studio. I just can't imagine what that must have felt like.
It was amazing because I came to Isaac. Isaac chose us. What happened was Al Bell, again, had decided to do these 30-some albums and flood the market with his eccentric idea, which it had never been done before by one record company to flood the market with all those with all that material. But he and Clive Davis had thought up this idea. And he did it, but out of the 30-some albums, I think it was, that were released by Stax. There were only about four of them that actually got off the ground. And my friend Johnny Baylor, he was responsible for Hot Buttered Soul being as big as it was because there was a joke that Johnny went to the disc jockeys and put a pistol to their head and told them to play it.
I'm going
to play
your
it again
out.
And play it again. So, and it was one of the first four song albums, LPs, to be released during that time. And then artists like Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, they followed suit. But it was amazing by Isaac because Isaac had one album. His first album was called Presenting Isaac Hayes.
Yeah.
Which was almost, if I'm not mistaken, Isaac did say that they were drunk the night they did that. And if you listen to it, it does sound that way because one song, Isaac is just going, There are no lyrics. There are no lyrics to the song.
He's just moaning through the whole thing.
Man.
It's like by the time I get to Phoenix, it's like 20 minutes before he gets the first lyric.
Yeah.
I have that in here, actually. It's like 18 and a half minute long tune.
And so that product didn't do well at all. I don't think they sold anything about that. There was a running joke that a partner of mine had tagged Isaac Hayes with. Isaac, when Isaac purchased the Mark 14 studio out on Chelsea and 7th, which had formerly belonged to Jerry Butler, our first recording there, LP recording, was a recording titled Juicy Fruit. Isaac had just signed with ABC Records, and he just threw something together. And my friend, his name is Howard Redman, He was a jokester. He said that Juicy Fruit was such a bad album that the initial order was for $250,000. The first return was $275,000.
Oh, my.
He said that they sent the displays back. They sent all the free copies, everything back.
Y'all can have this back. Yeah, it's stinking up the room.
They said it was terrible, man. And in a sense, I must agree, because there was nothing really tangible that a real music lover could
So
could
you had mentioned that
to.
All that stuff had been flooded out onto the market. Was Stax in the habit of just recording a bunch of stuff and sitting on it and waiting for that all to just come out at one time, or was it just paid out over a period of time?
No, they would usually do this. The writers were so prolific, and the musicians were so good in what they did.
Right.
Until out of each session would usually come what you knew was a hit record. So they wouldn't cut that much material for the can before they released, you know, some product.
I got you.
This was, like I said, an eccentric but brilliant idea by Al Bell when Al became vice president of Stax. He had this enormous idea. Al was full of ideas, inventions. He was before his time. And during that time, this this black identity, black power thing was. Mm-hmm. Luckily, the FBI let him let it go through. You know, some of the black leaders just pushed this thing.
It wasn't like you guys were on a watch list or anything. I mean, you were just a bunch of musicians over here.
Really surprised about a lot of the stuff that a lot of our black leaders were able to get away with.
You know?
Not get away with, but. We've always known that we had the laws and the freedoms to do what anybody else can do.
Right.
But some of these guys were just, they were headstrong. They would push through. And Al Bell just had to be, he happened to be one of those guys, man. He knew what the power was, and he enforced it.
So did he sit down with guys like yourself and Isaac and listen to what the perspective was from black artists into how it was going to be related into the community and what could Stax do?
He just knew it. He was very much in tune to that because Al was a disc jockey in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
All the northeastern states were really in tune with black power, as you can say.
Right.
Black pride, black laws, what our future should have been.
Right.
They were very in tune to that. And Al, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, all these guys, they were forerunners in the black movement. And so he had the number one heads up on what could and could not be.
Yeah.
And he was adamant about it, man. He used every trick in the book or every law that was available to him or to us.
Right.
He was on top of it.
Because one of the things that you think about when you hear of the stories that come out of Stax is that while you guys were in there making records, the city of Memphis was falling apart in places. And you had the race riots, and that was happening nationwide, but Memphis was in the middle of it. Then Dr. King gets killed, and then the shit hits the fan, and you guys are still in there trying to put something together out of all of this.
Well, you know,
it wasn't a color issue for that.
No, it wasn't, and Steve Cropper can attest to this because we just spoke on this subject at Stax. There was a photo tribute to Al Jackson, and all of us were there. But it was amazing. We were black, and we knew who we were and what had to be done. But when you walked through those doors at Stax Records, there was no. There may have been because I was young, you know, and I'm like part of the second or maybe the third generation of Stax. So there may have been some things hidden from me because I had heard of some quarrels that some things had gone on, but it never.
It wasn't involving race, though.
No, it wasn't. It was about women.
It's always about the broads.
Yeah, who's dating whose girlfriend, who's been with whose wife, and all this kind of stuff. You know,
typical musician stuff.
Believe it or not, man. And it wasn't even about money. At one point, it became about money, and that's when Stax started hiring all these different people, like Don Davis from Detroit, and getting all these enormous salaries.
It became a machine at that point, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. And most of the guys from the outside that came in, they didn't really have any of the Stax history in their blood.
Yeah.
And they didn't really care about any of that. It was like when you got these guys from the north and the east coming in, man, they're all about cash. And I tell you something that was really embarrassing. But it's the way these guys thought. Mickey Stevens, who was responsible for the song Mickey's Monkey that Smokey Robinson wrote.
Yeah.
His wife was Kim Weston. Mickey was at Stax mixing some stuff on Kim. Kim had signed with the one of the Stax subsidiaries. I got to know Mickey because Mickey worked late at night when nobody was there. Mickey was mixing in Studio B, which was upstairs. And I had just joined Isaac's band, so I would come in late at night And just practice by myself on the drums, you know, just practicing.
What a great room to practice in, though.
Yeah, man, how to solo and, you know, just cutting loose. I was happy to be a part of Isaac's group, and I wanted to be better at my craft.
Yeah.
So during this week, Mickey Stevens was there, and he was mixing Kim Weston's album, his wife. So I wandered into the control room, and we got to talking. He was a real cordial guy. And we started talking about the difference between Motown and Stax. And he broke down and told me, he said, "Willie, you know, there's a running joke in Detroit about Stax." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You know, they say you can come to Memphis and cut a whole album for $25. And I'm like, oh man, is that what is that the way they feel about
us? No,
you know what I
no,
mean? And it was
no.
like, you know, like we were some, like we were some sub level
right,
musicians
right.
and record company or something.
But, I'm insulted from hearing that, and I know that was
what?
So long.
Yeah, but I'm not surprised that there was some sense of rivalry between.
Well, yeah.
Well, no, believe it or not, that statement wasn't about the rivalry. What it really pointed to was this. And I hope nobody's offended. The Memphis Local 71, when it was run by Bob Taylor, who was a great guy now, don't get me wrong. But there was a lot of underhanded things going on.
That's shady. That's show business, though, Willie. You know
yeah, yeah,
that.
Yeah. Shady stuff, which I almost got blackballed for trying to bring it to the surface. We as musicians weren't being paid. Here we were. I was 17. Michael Toes was 16.
It's amazing. It's so good that they fixed that now, though, that the times have changed so much. That,
well,
I'm
yeah.
kidding. I'm being sarcastic.
Well,
they haven't fixed shit,
man.
Now we're being looked at more heavily by the National Union, the American Federation of Musicians. But back in the late 60s, man... they were sort of like turning a deaf ear to the musicians in Memphis. And I tell you why. Well, I tell you what happened. We would go in. We were so young and dumb, man. We should be millionaires now, a lot of us. We would go in the studio. Guys, not just Isaac Hayes, but all the artists at Stax, even Jim Stewart himself. We would go in. We're covered by the National Union. We're covered by the local union. We're supposed to get paid so many $100 every 3.5 hours, which is noted as a session.
Right.
Session time.
Right.
Man, we would go in and do 5 songs, which still added up to almost 2 hours of music. And they would only give us maybe $160. They would only turn in 1 or 2 sessions. And we've done a whole album.
Right.
Okay. Which should have been... Every 3 hours, you know, somebody should have been taking notes and noting that that was one
session. Some accounting of some sort.
Yes. But see, we were young and we were hot as fire, and all their producers knew it. Everything that the young guys, this particular session was touching was turning to gold and platinum.
Yeah.
So everybody was rushing us in the studio to record for them. And none of us had the knowledge.
So at that point, you're just happy to be there and be playing and not even thinking about that.
Okay, you just got off the road. You got about $700 in your pocket.
Yeah.
And you done gave your girlfriend $500 and your mom $300 and all the wife and kids are taken care of. So, you know, and you're only 17 years old.
And then you're back in the studio laying some stuff down and you're becoming immortal, you know.
Yeah.
Well, real quick,
but
though.
But you're dumb at the same time.
Those sessions, you guys were cranking music out. Now, in those days, it was all performed. There wasn't too much overdubbing, right? I mean, it was everybody in the same room for the most part. I mean, is that how you guys worked? I mean, it was a pretty quick turnaround to get from composition to final product.
Usually, you know, there are two kinds of producers.
Yeah.
The ones that come in with knowing what they want, and the ones that come in and let you somehow finagle you to make up the song.
Right. Here's what I'm thinking, Willie.
Hey,
give
man,
me a shuffle beat on it.
You know. Tell you something. What you got, man? You got charts? You got... You know. No, just give me a F minor. Just play on the F minor right there. All right. And if one of the musicians take off on a lick or something, yeah, I like that. Keep playing.
Oh,
that.
I get, yeah. You know, it was kind of feeling it all the way
man,
through.
Man, you wouldn't believe how many songs the musicians actually wrote.
Yeah.
And then you have the guys that would come like from the east or the west with the charts that nobody could read. You
right.
know?
Yeah. So, you know, all right, fellas, here's what we're going to do.
It came all kinds of ways. But the, usually the overdubs would be. Like
backup vocals or that kind of stuff, or
backup vocals, guitar solos.
Yeah,
like myself, I would do all my percussion on Isaac's stuff. Isaac and I would split percussions. Like there was one song, "The Look of Love," I played bongos, and Isaac actually played tambourine on Shaft.
Yeah,
but on the credits it says drums and tambourine by Willie Hall. I played tambourine on most of the other stuff on Chef, but he actually played tambourine on Chef.
So when it came to Lay Down, like that song, let's use that as an example, it would be you in the rhythm section, or that was it, and you'd start from there and then build on top of it, or was the orchestra in there going?
No. It would be Isaac who would compose everything. He'd hand out the whole parts.
Yeah.
Actually, and not you know, to give all the credit to myself, but a lot of songs that Isaac did, it would just be he and I would lay the initial track.
Right.
He would tell the rest of the guys to take a break, and he Clarence, which is my nickname, and that's what he would call me. Hey, Clarence, give me a beat. And he would give me the tempo, and I'd start the beat, and he'd compose on the keyboard. But most of the songs, even with Billy Eckstein, Sammy Davis, all those guys that we cut, it would be like anywhere, no more than a four-piece rhythm section.
Yeah.
It would be Isaac, the bass player, guitar player, myself, and that would be it.
And that would just be that session, guy. And then from there you
and,
would,
and yeah. Lester Snell on keyboard. So it would be like Isaac, a keyboard, Lester Snell, Michael Toews, James Alexander, and myself, the five pieces. We would lay all the tracks. And then usually at the end of that night, Isaac would ask, one of the musicians, if he wanted to do a guitar solo at a
sure.
certain point, Michael would stay and do the guitar solo. And then he would get with guys like Unzi Horn, Johnny Allen, all the composers, and Lester Snell, and then they would compose the music, and he'd bring in the Memphis Symphony.
That's a lot of work for, what, $100 a song?
You know? Yeah, it was at that
if
time.
If my math is
and
right, then, you and got
then
hosed.
Then the fee, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, big time, man. when the clouds cleared and the drugs wore off,
yeah.
You know, we started counting that money, man, and that time, and it was amazing. Like, what?
But see, you were working for Stax, not for Isaac, right? That's a notable difference because Isaac.
Eventually, this happened. Initially, you were just an independent musician. You'd be called in for
session cat, yeah.
Once Hot Buttered Soul happened, Isaac went to Alan Jones, the producer of the Barcades, and asked Alan if the Barcades could be his band. Right. Alan didn't want to break the Barcades up. So Isaac...
And understandably so, yeah.
Isaac initially hired some other players. James Alexander and Alan Jones and I couldn't see eye to eye on certain things. And so I left the Barcades. Isaac had already offered all of us a job.
Sure.
So I got with Isaac, and he said, you know, call my secretary in the morning, and you were hired. So, initially, Isaac wanted the whole band to be his, and eventually we did become his band. So what happened was when Hot Buttered Soul came out, they arranged it to where the Barcades would open Isaac's show. We'd do our bit. Take a break, change clothes, and then we come out as Isaac's band.
Oh, yeah.
And that worked real well.
Yeah.
And he would carry the Memphis Symphony in one of the buses. And
make it a little bit easier on the touring,
well, man, you know.
Oh, yeah. We heard those stories.
Look, the symphony had a hard time dealing with all those brothers.
Yeah, because there was all these white kids over there with violins and oboes going, I don't know.
But, I don't know about these guys, man.
Yeah.
I think they're smoking something. It smells weird.
They had to put them on their own bus, man. So eventually they became three buses. But a lot of
But by the end of the tour, they were hanging with you guys.
Lot of the white guys, man, like Jack Hale, and yeah. There was another Jack that played trombone. They started being on our bus, man, because,
yeah.
You know, the guys on our bus, they would take the seats out, man, and shoot crap all the way to San Francisco, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we had a lot of fun.
That's great.
The symphony is a lot of great people.
Let me grab a break here, Willie. We'll come back. Sure. You're going to hang with us tonight?
For sure.
We're going to play a couple of tunes, some of the stuff that you've been on. I've got some other things we want to kind of get into. Oh, before I forget, Jeff,
I saw that.
I pulled that out of there to remind you, Memphis homeboy done good.
Yes, yes, I know, and he's going to be on this show.
Right? Yes, next week. Cedric Burnside.
Grammy nominee.
He's going to be here next week.
Cedric Burnside.
Yeah, the Cedric Burnside Project, Descendants of Hill Country, is an incredible record, and it is deservedly so.
Yes.
Nominated as Best Blues Album, I understand.
That's huge. That's huge.
From the Burnside family.
Yeah, that's RL's
he's
grandson.
He's the one that plays drums and sings. So
I did a show with one of the boys that plays guitar. I forget his name.
Might have been Gary.
No. You know, there's like 14 of them.
Yeah, there's
get
like,
the list
there's
out.
Like 20 Burnsides out there.
There's a whole brood of them. But yeah, that record there is absolutely fantastic. Get it. It's well worth that.
That's awesome. I can't believe we're going to have him in here. So.
And while I'm thinking about it, Boo Mitchell has also been nominated for
Uptown Funk.
For Uptown Funk. Yes. He got it for, he didn't get it, but he's been, the nomination, that's huge. That's a good deal. So
yeah, that's one of the few ways I was able to connect with my kids. Because, you know, I do this show, and they don't care about the blues, they don't care about old Memphis soul music.
But they should.
Oh, no, they absolutely should, but I was at one of my daughter's performances of School of Rock. They were playing a Hard Rock Cafe, and out of nowhere, Boo Mitchell came up. I was like, hey, Jeff, what's going on? He shook my hand, we hugged.
Oh, yeah.
And he laughed, and my son goes, who's that? It's like, it's Boo Mitchell, man. That's Willie Mitchell's son. He looks at me blank, like, I have no idea.
Who the hell is that?
You know, I said, that's the guy that produced Uptown Funk, and his eyes went wide. Like, holy crap, you know that guy? Yeah.
That's funny. What is that?
Steve told me to give you this divinity. He handed this to a woman and said, give it to a man.
I don't want divinity. I'm divine as it is. Give it to Willie.
Give it to Willie. He needs to be defined.
It's white. It's white candy. I don't know how that's going to go with your conscience over there, Willie.
Well, you know, white is not a bad tasting candy.
You know, Diana here is she is of Asian persuasion, if you will, and we've talked about this before, but your nickname, Too Big.
Oh no. Uh-oh.
I don't know that Diana has heard it from you, but that story when you first told it, I got so much email off of it, and people were going, is that the truth? Is that really? And I said, it came from Willie. It has to be the truth because Willie doesn't lie.
And Big Willie doesn't either. No. This is not an X-rated show, please.
Well, okay, then we'll save it for off the air.
Oh, no. All
right. I'll let you tell her in private.
But it was just a mix-up.
As it were, you had traveled the world with the Blues Brothers, and of course wound up in Japan and dealing with this. That band, and we've said this before, you were part, and it comes from that line from John Belushi in the film. You guys were the backbone of the swinginess, the hippest thing that had ever been created, and. I go back and listen to I've listened to the Blues Brothers for years, but you go back and you listen to it in retrospective and you hear the sounds that you guys made. He was not lying. That was some serious, serious music that was being made by that. And I know it came from different sources. There's a lot of Memphis in there. There's a lot of Chicago. There's a lot of Atlanta in there. Paul Schaefer, I think, wasn't he one of the ones that kind of put it together? And
he was like the band leader, wasn't he?
And Bones Malone, you know, all, that whole bunch. And then here's Willie on the drums just tearing it the F up. That was something, man. You guys really had something.
Well, you know, every decade, century, 5, 10, 7 years or so, a phenomenon happens in music, you know, a game changer or something that has been missing, or you can put something together that'll capture that buying generation.
There you go.
The paying generation, whether it's the young kids or the mid-age, the baby boomers or whatever. The collaboration of the idea that whoever initiated it, John, Dan, John Landis, some Universal executive, that the collaboration of that initial idea to go from an idea to an actual event. That just happened to be the catalyst for something that was unusually on time at that time.
It was lightning in a bottle is a good way to describe it, because you had the bit that was on Saturday Night Live from John and Dan, well, and then there was that great band behind it, and then all of a sudden it really turned into this monster.
What? I've read up on this. I've read the Wikipedia entry on it. I mean, I followed the Blues Brothers. As I understood it, they started that skit on Saturday Night Live, but Aykroyd was taking Belushi to like clubs after they were done rehearsing for the day, and they were hanging out with like Paul Schaefer and all these cats and getting into this music that I guess they had kind of grown up on.
Right.
Because at that point in 1980, like all the Barquets and all that Booker T and the MGs, all that stuff was already
that era. Yeah, that was that era.
Yeah. It was always
you had to catch that era in, let's say.
But it was the idea that started like took all that music
50s,
yeah,
60s. Then the collaboration of the stuff in the 70s.
Yeah.
And that event at that particular time with that collaboration of people just happened to be right on time.
Oh, yes. It was perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. Yeah.
And that was the beauty.
That had grown up with that same music.
That was the beauty of being a part of it. Because, yeah, like, myself as a drummer and a player in the bit, I didn't have to go through any changes. This was just a blessing that fell out of the sky. And so I didn't have to audition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where my name came up or
who brought it up
or what this discussion was, but somehow I was chosen.
Yeah.
You know? And
was
and,
it but, had you been playing for the Barquets before that? Was it my timing may be off on that.
The career started with the Barquets after the plane crash.
And then
Isaac Hayes. And
so the Blues Brothers was the last.
So I'm going to be honest with you, man. When I first saw the Blues Brothers, I paid them no attention.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed what was going on, and systematically I saw what was going on with every player and the whole image of what they were projecting. And then I tried to look into the authenticity, the soul of the performers, Danny and John. I saw Danny, a serious creator, and I saw John as the voice, the actual talent, you know. So I looked at it, I said, oh, a bunch of groups. I said, oh, they got Steve Cropper, they got everybody from Memphis and New York mixed up in there.
Yeah.
I said, that's great, and they're imitating R&B singers. I said,
it's white guys trying to play the blues, and that's an immediate thought that comes in and go, I don't know if they're going
to
pull this off.
When you say trying to play the blues, you're speaking in an amateur sense.
Right.
These were actual
blues
creators.
Yeah. I mean, look at the rhythm section for this. Duck Dunn, so that was monster.
That was a smart, however it came together. You could say some really intelligent executive put it together, or you can just say it just happened. But that was a smart move. And they got the Memphis music.
Yeah.
Now, and see, I used to hang out with Danny during the set or whatever, and these guys had their own trailers at certain times. And in their trailer, among other things, was good music, man.
Right.
Good R&B, Coco Taylor.
They were definitely coming to that place of reverence
Danny,
for that music.
Danny
was,
they were real R&B music. They knew, naturally, when you're a certain age as a musician, you've been in it a few years, you know all the songs. Mm-hmm. But these guys, their hearts were with R&B blues music.
Right.
Yeah. They weren't imitators.
No.
By being white boys saying Blues Brothers. That's why Aretha's line was Blues
Brothers.
Shit. This is not an X-rated show.
No, but you can cuss. You can say whatever you want here.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and Dan Aykroyd, to his credit, is very well educated when it comes to the blues. He's very well versed in it.
And he can actually play.
He does. He's a player, yeah.
He no changes in the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
John and I, once John gave a party somewhere, and it was at a house. It was almost like a ranch. And John and I got a chance to bond that night because we both had our feel of whatever the weekend held. But at the particular point, I walked on his property with him, and we looked up at, you know how you can be out in the county and you can actually see the stars?
Yeah.
We had that moment sitting on the rail on one of his rail.
Yeah.
Where they kept the horses. But anyway, man, he could actually play drums. He could play a little guitar.
Really?
Tell you a short story. I may have said it before. I think I did. But this is for the ones that didn't hear it before.
Yeah.
John, we had just finished the scene in which one of the jailhouse rock scenes with
In the prison Steve, yeah, at the end of the film?
And,
yeah.
And in the Joliet Jake. Yeah, it was in the prison.
Yeah.
Okay, we had just finished that one of those shots. It was lunchtime, so everybody breaks out going to lunch. I left out before some of the guys. I went and sat down. I always carried an acoustic guitar with me. So I'm sitting there playing country chords, C, A, minor, G, you know. So I'm over in the corner by myself. So John and about Lou Marini, John, Tom, and Alan, who was the big jokester, they all were walking out, and they saw me sitting over in the corner playing these twang chords. So John turned and looked at me. He stopped. He said, wait a minute. He walked over to me, reached in his pocket, and grabbed all the change in his pocket and threw it at my feet. You treat me so kind, you know, and I love that. But I think what it is, you're just an avid lover of music and musicians and things like that. And
I mentioned this to you the first time you were there, but see, for me... I mean, the Blues, I know the Blues Brothers was to you maybe, a year of your life, 2 years of your life total?
No, it's been from 1980 until today.
But the time you were actively
I'm living that Blues Brothers thing every day. And believe me, it's a blessing in a sense and in a sense.
And I understand, but I tell you what, for me, all of my love for music starts, that movie was the catalyst for me getting into music in the first place.
Wow.
So it's absolutely important to me.
You know, and I hear things like this all over the world, you know, from family, friends, and people from different countries. It's amazing the effect that song, music, poetry, and movies have on the emotions.
And not to just make it about that, but to dig deeper into the Barquets, again, as a lifelong Memphian, this is stuff that comes from the same water I came from, the same mud that I came from.
That's beautiful, man.
You know, I treasure it.
And you know what was great for me during the whole, the first time somebody told me, say, hey, man, we need you to fly to Chicago and do this movie, and this and this will happen and that will happen. And, hey, man, I got that phone call that afternoon, that evening.
Yeah.
That night, I couldn't even sleep in the bed. My stomach was in an uproar. And my girlfriend at the time told me, say, it was just the nerves dealing with the reality of...
Were you scared?
I can't explain what it was because the pain was so intense, I couldn't even tell what I was going through. And it didn't have anything to do with anything. It was just the moment I hung that phone up, she said that reality just... You know.
Just mess with you a little
bit. Yeah. And that's why I know if I was a millionaire, I'd be dead. I would. Yeah,
maybe the good Lord had a reason, right?
Yeah, because a lot of money has passed my hands in the last 30 years. But I can't seem to hold on to any of it. So maybe it's a good thing. I've often said to my wife, bless her heart, hey, Deborah. And I want to send a shout out to Patrick. Patrick, you missed it.
Oh, yeah.
Gangster Pat, he missed it. He was going to be here, but...
I told DJ Bay that he might be here.
He said his girlfriend run off with the car. You know,
He
must be doing the wrong thing.
Oh, no. No, we can't have all that.
She don't trust him.
Well, you know, now that you mentioned Pat...
wish you were here, man.
Did Pat come through the music industry through you, or was it something that he discovered on his own?
No, Patrick is my firstborn in 72. He was always around music.
Yeah.
And during the time we lived in Whitehaven.
I love how you did it. Whitehaven.
what I did was...
it's a bad place. Come on, Willie.
No, it's just ironic. It's called Whitehaven because the white folks moved there first, and I'm sure it was a haven away from the city. But now there's so many...
I made that joke when I first moved here myself.
But there's so many people of color living there now till it's just like ironic, you know. But it did have an initial meaning.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I like the joke, Rich.
I do too, man.
Especially after a doobie, man. Come on, man.
What are you speaking of, Willie? Nothing of this.
You're either a genius or you're a jokester. Right.
We've got it all figured out, my friend. No, I kid with you. No, but you guys had moved here. When you guys, you came here in what, 67?
65.
65.
My family moved here from
Pensacola. And Pat was born in
72.
72, uh-huh. Yeah. So he grew up there.
So he grew up with music all around him, you know. We would tour. you know, with Isaac, and with the, you know, he grew up with it. A funny story, in my living room in Whitehaven, I had electric piano,
yeah,
the Wurlitzer, and I had all kinds of guitars, and I actually had a drum set set up in my living room. So Pat was always music enthusiast, and he was so small till he'd crawl up on the seat, and then he'd play the top of the drum, you know, like a child.
So he went to the drums, right? Like his daddy.
First of all.
Yeah,
because they're easier. They're right. The boom, boom, boom. Every black
makes
man
a great sound.
Every black man has some Indian in him. So listen. So he was so small, he'd crawl up on the seat, and then he'd take the sticks, bam, 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 and then he'd crawl off the seat and take his foot and hit the bass drum, boom, boom, boom.
Oh,
then
yeah.
Then he'd crawl back up. He'd get out and go boom, boom, boom.
But he's discovering sounds, and he's...
At 3 years old.
Yeah.
Three, and eventually, yeah. I was telling Alpha Brown tonight that I don't use the word pride, but I was very happy because on all of his CDs, and he has some really good stuff.
Yeah.
On all of his CDs, you know, he plays every instrument, he does the engineering, he writes the song, he does the mixes, he does the whole thing. And I'm really happy because I was telling Dr. Alfred that, see, that shows a lot about a person that plays everything.
Yeah.
It takes time to play chords on a guitar.
Yeah, it does.
Play them effectively.
And get the count still down.
To learn. Okay. And it takes time to learn the piano. It takes time to learn the bass. And it takes time to learn the drums. And for a person to be able to do this, that meant that they spent a lot of collective, and just to play these instruments is not enough, but to play them effectively, you know, and to make each track mean something relative to the other tracks.
Right, right. Yeah,
and he does that very well. He said he just got disillusioned with the with some things that had happened in his career.
It happens, mm-hmm. and you know, you of all well, you know people what? I'm with glad. No show business would
I'm really,
fuck a guy over.
I'm really glad he did choose the workman's route. You know, he works a job, he pays taxes, Social Security, whole nine yards. I'm really more happy about that because the music industry is like going to the casino. You know, some days you leave there. Some days will be lucrative, and some days will be like, much, yeah. I really days, hate myself, you know.
Some days that's a long drive
so
back
because in the long run, I'm a senior citizen, and like millions of us, we know it's important to have security. It would have been the idea that you would have had enough business savvy to start. Because a lot of the groups, like the Nashville groups, Reggie Young and all those guys, they had a thing where they were cutting so many hits and everybody was using the musicians in that studio. So they had a contract with the artist that when they come in, you know, we get points. What made me mad was Al Bell went to most of the shows to record the Staple Singers, and he gave those musicians points on I'll Take You There and all that stuff. And man, he never offered that to any of us at Stax. And that left me a little pissed off when I found out about it 20 years later.
Well, and it does happen. And that's...
It's business savvy, man. You have to know when you're hot. And when you're hot, try to find people that you can form ventures with.
Well, it's just from the outside looking at it, sounds like part of it also is... And any young musician out there listening now should be aware of this. Is you know, you're, mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting to play, you're getting paid to play, and that's all fun and games, and that's cool. But that train doesn't last forever. You got to look out for.
Yeah, yeah. In this business, because it's not a, it's not a long term.
Right.
And
it's easy. It's easy when you're having fun to just not think about getting.
I'm amazed every day when I hear street talk about the different rappers and different musicians in the industry and the numeral name of the digits that they're making today. It's amazing, man. They're making millions, some of these guys.
Yeah.
And are they making it on record sales, downloads,
merch,
ticket sales?
What I would do was if I was a young guy and I had a hit record, whether I was a rapper or country and western or whatever, and my first record went platinum or gold, you know, each release, which
you can never beat the sequel. I mean, you can never equal a sequel with a sequel, the initial success that you had on the first record. So what I would do was, instead of losing money each time I put out a sequel to a hit, I would ask that my points and my artist royalties increase, because naturally after that first hit, everything else is sort of downhill until you come back with something else. So the smart thing to do, each year I sign, my points go up and my percentages go up. That's the only way you're going to make any money. Yeah. But it was quite an experience. It was an experience for me to be able to talk about it, because there were a lot of flaws, but most of the flaws came from non-education of the business of music.
Yeah, but you learned it on the road, though. You know.
Yeah, but learning it ain't about shit if you can't put it in your pocket.
It's paying the dues, my man. It's paying the dues. You know.
That's what I mean. It's a story about
you
it.
You did
but,
pay your dues, and that's.
But,
well, I mean, most musicians don't
like
even
anybody,
have a,
like anybody, man. I like anybody. I want to be rich.
You know, like, you know, you got these artists that go up on The Voice or America's Got Talent. It's like, you know what? Fuck you. You didn't pay your dues.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's moral sanity in what you say,
yeah, but
Rick,
you know, the,
but I got to
look at
it in a
month. Don't try and sell me that those artists over there
are
worth the shit.
But I'm saying,
that kid from Memphis that's doing well on The Voice, fuck him. Mm-hmm. He didn't pay his dues.
The problem with that's all those too. Shows, though, is you end up with somebody that you're putting a bankroll behind that hasn't paid their dues.
Right.
So they're going to implode at any time. It's not like they're ready to handle it.
Exactly.
I mean, that with that kind of success comes a lot of pressure.
Well, one thing about it, if you don't pay your dues, you're just a flash in the pan.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually if you pay your dues,
bingo,
you become a legend. And legend only means
I just,
old.
Yeah, but you know, I just listened to an interview with the guy that plays James Bond, Daniel Craig.
Yes.
And he was talking about, like, thank God I was an actor for 15 years before I became James Bond, because if I'd been, like, just a 20-year-old unknown actor, that all of a sudden they're throwing James Bond money at you and giving you, like, that. There's a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure that comes with it that most people can't handle.
Like a kid that plays very good basketball in college and he winds up in the NBA, and they throw $30 million a year at him.
I mean, Willie, if you threw $30 million a year at me for 2 years, I'd be dead within five.
Yeah, that's right. Either from overexertion
or different
stress.
They give you.
Different stress. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But I honestly thank God for the good and the bad.
A lot of people don't understand copyright law. When you go into a recording session, you don't know what your rights are about that session, and all of that's negotiable.
Sure.
Ultimately, it's all negotiable.
Yeah, it's about education, man.
Yeah.
If you become any kind of a commodity in the music industry.
But the people that are out there, if you haven't educated yourself, they're not going to help you. You know?
And everybody won't be educated, and sometimes it's good not to have an educated you know. Yeah, let the music. Because all of the old blues singers, Muddy Waters, Lightning Hopkins, Big Maybell, Big Mama Thornton, all that. Their success came from the quality of the music that they created.
Yes.
You know, and they never had monetary
They didn't have a marketing machine behind
but
them, yeah.
Whoever retained ownership of the stuff of the rights of the stuff that was passed down, monetarily, you know, they became lucrative. But the point is that when you're a creator like that and you know you have something special, it becomes not about money. You know, you do what the spirit is forcing you to do.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about a lot of them.
Well, you know, you hear about, I was just reading something about this not too long ago. You know, Disney, they spent a lot of money with, like, the lobbying and all that other stuff to change copyright law, because by copyright law, all those creations like Mickey Mouse should be public domain by now.
Sure.
Under copyright at the time, it's like 50 years past
like
the lifetime of the original creator.
He's like 70.
So when you get
yeah.
stuff from what did you say it should be? When you get stuff from public domain, what do you do? You pay a license for the
you don't pay
for
anything.
You can use it for so many years.
Like the song "Happy Birthday."
Well, like Mark Twain, Mark Twain's writings, Like, he, like, I think the copyright extended 50 years past when he died. You get one chance to re-up that, like, the estate
so
can re-up that.
So who gets the royalties?
Well, now it's public. After that, it goes to public domain. There are no royalties. Okay. If you wanted to go
If you wanted to shoot your own version
of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer right now, you don't have to pay anybody anything because nobody owns those royalties. It's public domain. I think Sherlock Holmes is the same way.
Well, BMI, that's good for BMI because they don't have anybody to pay.
That's really cool. But see, now what Disney did is because like characters like Mickey Mouse were created by Walt Disney, and then at the 50-year mark, his estate redid it, and then that, I think that goes for another 20 or 30 years, but then that expires, and it's those characters are supposed to go to the public domain, but then a company like Disney's got enough money to make sure this shit's never going to be in the public domain. Yeah,
yeah. That's good. That's good for the writers. You know, one thing, Ted Turner owns, I know he owns the original Blues Brothers. I don't know if he has ownership of Blues. Yeah, Turner owns that now.
Well, he ain't going to be around much longer. I mean, then.
But I was wondering. I don't know if he has ownership of Blues Brothers 2000. But one thing about one thing about the Turner conglomerate is it has given royalties to a lot of old movie actors and musicians. You know, because he's in a constant rotation of the old material. You know, and you can look forward to so many hours on the air. Of any nostalgic movie from the Turner organization every year.
Sure.
And because, you know, I'm from the old school, and I still receive royalties because of the airplay that Turner gives to the product that
right.
I'm involved
in. Right.
Yeah. So he's helping a lot of us, man.
So you get the check that's for like $2?
Yeah, it's been there.
My
mother told me once. Like one time, I got one from BMI for 14 cents.
No, oh.
So my mother told me. She said, "Don't be downhearted, baby," because I was like in a boohoo, you know.
Don't be downhearted, honey. It's 14 cents. Yeah.
She says, "Hey Willie, you've got a check here." She didn't open it because she knew better. But anyway, I'll kill my mother. I'll kill you if you open my mail.
So,
but anyway. She didn't have any idea how much it was because of this agreement we had. But she said, "You got a check here." So she waited impatiently, and so did I. I rushed over there, man. I was not on E. I was on D. And I run over to the house and got my little check and opened it up, man. It said 0.14. God, I cried, man.
You are a professional musician.
I didn't have no gas, and I owed everybody.
All right, did you get any royalties out of the Blues Brothers? No, I think about it.
I still, under what they call a producer's pension plan.
Yeah, I don't want to expose any of that, but you know,
when that movie airs, you get a check.
You still get money for that.
There's nothing to expose. Under that producer's pension plan, all the characters in the Blues Brothers band, we share in a royalty every 90 days.
So it's a pool, right? Yeah.
Well, no, the plan takes so much from the net.
Right.
And it divides that between the percentages that each musician has.
I got you. So for the living artists and those that have passed that go to the estate. And,
right.
Welcome to copyright law talk with Rick and Jeff. But let me ask you this. Would there be any benefit to you if there was like some sort of push? I know I think the movie came out in 80, right?
Yeah, the first
so, one. So, well, maybe 5 years from now to do a 40th anniversary edition and do like the special release DVD, would that do anything?
Quiet as it was kept, there were plans to do a third Blues Brothers movie. The second
one. Oh, man. Really?
Yeah. But it was going to go from like this. The band and the young kid from the second one, he was going to inherit a whole nother band. And we were going to come in as old guys and do a cameo. So it was going to take a whole nother level.
All right, but maybe glad that didn't happen.
Alan Rubin.
Yes,
a couple of the guys in there. After the second movie, the second movie involved the young kid.
Yeah,
the second movie involved the young kid. That was to be the young kid was to be the catalyst into the new generation of Blues
Brothers. Right.
But some of the members died before the script was finished, and I guess Danny just didn't feel that.
Wow.
And who knows? Maybe there'll be a revision.
But not just from a Blues Brothers point of view, but if there was a big push right now for, like a Barclays box set, would that
include anything that I've done?
Yeah, would that, well, not, would that be like one of those things that, like, hey, if there was a big sale on that, you would, you know.
I'd benefit from some of the, yeah. I got involved with the Blues Brothers the Barclays in 1968 after the plane crash in December of 67. And some of the songs that the new Barclays, as we call ourselves, wrote as we released different product from.
So those pieces, I guess what I'm getting is, yeah, I got there's still some life in those
songs,
those projects that you worked on.
Are they still paying?
You could get a renaissance out of them. Something could spark again. Well, look,
In third world countries, Europe and Australia, we're still receiving royalties from some of the old stuff.
And I got to tell you, after the first time we had you on here, I had listened to the Barclays. I'd never gotten into the Black Rock stuff.
Black Rock is the only one that got a groove.
I've different direction now. I've listened to all of it. Right. Oh, yeah, man. After having you in here, I had, yes, sir.
It's a different direction from Black Rock.
Willie?
Well, guys, we're going to
Yeah, I know. He's here. Willie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode from Radioland with Rick Cheddar.
Tonight in here, of course, Mr. Howard Grimes, Ms. Tony Green is in here. Anna will be here at some point, hopefully. And John Gary Williams is here from the Badlands.
Yes.
How are you, my friend?
I'm great. I'm blessed.
I'm glad to have you in here. This is your first time in here.
It's my very first time.
One of the things that we have noticed since we have been here is the resurgence of Memphis music, especially over the past several years, the past 3, 4, 5 years. People are really starting to pay attention of what's coming out of this city.
Finally.
And on the shoulders of what you guys have done, and you as well.
Yes.
Have laid down over the history of the music scene in this town, I think is so important because a lot of the youngsters that are out there, they're copying into it, they're jumping into it, and they're making it their own, and we're hearing some fantastic stuff.
Right there.
That's it.
See, that's the way it was.
Simple. Nothing fancy, nothing.
Simple. Just
very simple.
For previous episodes, go to radio-memphis.com. To download episodes to your mobile device, search the show in iTunes, Player.fm, Stitcher.com, Pocket Cast, or TuneIn. And now, here's more with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
Need to do some gift giving, perhaps. I know the holidays have happened. So what? You got birthday. My birthday happens after the holiday. And nobody got me anything. Well, that's not necessarily true. I did acquire an absolutely delightful lava lamp. It came to us from our friends at Wizards. Here in Memphis, people know about Wizards. They're a great gift shop, alternative smoke joint, 1999 Madison Avenue, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., but they also sell a bunch of this groovy stuff online. Yep, no matter where you are, you can check it out. They'll ship it to you. It's beautiful. Find them. There is a link on our website at radio-memphis.com, and it'll take you to Wizards. Take a look at it and get yourself something cool, like one of them really groovy lava lamps. They come in some different styles and colors and stuff like that. So get you one at Wizards because it's still smoking. All right, you heard what's coming up next time around, but we'll continue on here. We've got some music here for you, as we do. Had to pull this one. This was something that Willie gave us. Willie said, yes, play this. This is a good tune. It came from the album Chocolate Chip. It was Isaac Hayes' studio release, studio album done in June of 1975. It was recorded at Hot Buttered Soul Recording Studios here in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's a great tune. It's actually a great album, the entire album. There's seven tracks on here, including an instrumental version of the song we're about to play. On it, of course, Mr. Isaac Hayes, Ben Cawley on trumpet. We just lost Ben not too terribly long ago. He passed away. Mr. Bill Easley playing some sax and flute over here. Lewis Collins. Of course, Willie Hall plays all the drums here. And there were some good artists on here. It's a great tune. What it is, it's the title track. It's Chocolate Chip right here on the old show from Radioland. That's what I was thinking. God, what am I drunk? No, I'm not. It's Isaac Hayes, Willie Hall on drums. Chocolate Chip from Radioland.
I'm a stupid player in the street.
See, that's that disco, funk, and soul sound there that's indicative of Mr. Hayes. Absolutely delightful stuff. So there. Hey, listen, if you're new to the show, first of all, welcome to it. Thank you so much for giving us of your time. You can find us in a whole ton of places. You can just Google search my name. It's Rick Cheddar, R-I-C-C-H-E-T-T-E-R. This show comes up. It's also in a number of locations. I was just recently, something else that was kind of groovy about this show is that we were invited to submit it to Google Play. What? Google Play has podcasts? No, not yet. That's just it. Yet is the operative word here because they haven't. They haven't done it just yet. So they're obviously getting ready to launch their version of the podcast thing there. So our show is already in the queue over there. I guess they're getting the last of their podcast players put together for the Google Play store. So that's coming very soon. In the meantime, you can find us in a ton of other locations as well. Including iTunes, yes, for all of you Apple guys. Just search it there. And we're at Stitcher, player.fm. There's a ton of places. And by the way, while I'm thinking about it, if you want to see some more about this show and the other shows, I have a blogspot page that I've just converted into another place to put it. And I'll often write some more personal notes about what happened in this program. You can find that at rickcheddar.blogspot.com. You can find it there, plus some other groovy stuff. And I've had that thing for years. And of course, at the home, radio-memphis.com. Please share the show, if you would, please. Tell your friends about it. And if you'd like to get involved with the program, if you're somebody who would like to get on the show, or if you'd like to book the program into your venue, we're starting to think about that as well. Shoot us a line, radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. That's radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. We'd love to hear from you. How about that? Sometimes I check it myself. All right, kids, I'm done. I'm out of here. Y'all take care of yourselves. Take care of one another. We'll see you next time. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. All music performed during this episode was used by permission. No part of this program can be rebroadcast or used in any other way except by written consent. For bookings and other inquiries, you can write the show by sending an email to radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. For more, go to radio-memphis.com.